My name is Kelly Sears.
And my name is Patrick Sears, and welcome to the Frontal Harvest podcast. And this is podcast number 3, I think?
3 is correct.
Is it? Okay. Mm-hmm. And it is February 15th. Mm-hmm. And so, let's see. Well, we're kind of winging this, and we forgot to print up our notes.
Right.
So, what do we have? We have 3 parts. We're going to talk about our blogs, and then topics of interest.
Right.
And then future plans.
Exactly.
Okay. So, do you want to do your blog first?
Sure. One of the things that really surprised me is that Pat and I made this commitment to write a blog together a year ago.
That's almost a year ago.
Almost a year ago. We didn't quite get to it immediately, but now that we have, and we've made a commitment to writing a post every 2 weeks, it has really kind of, it's had an effect that is unexpected and wonderful. One thing is, you know how you have those commutes to work, and we drive to work together, and I drop Pat off, and then I go back to
because school. It's the winter.
It's the winter. He usually rides his bike. And our conversations have totally changed, where now as we talk, whether it's before the podcast or after the podcast, it has a lot to do with what we're doing, what we're thinking about, and what we're thinking to do for our next step. And I've just been pleasantly surprised with how I thought that it would be a job, a commitment to keep up with.
A commitment and a chore.
And a chore, yeah.
Or possibly a chore sometimes.
Possibly
sometime.
A chore. Yeah, it was something we're both eager to do. We didn't know really how to do it or what platform we really wanted.
Yep. Well, I read a draft of your blog, and I haven't read the final one, but I've had the absolute same feeling just from the draft, that this has been a really fantastic thing. So, should we go on to mine?
Yeah.
Because we've had a crazy week.
Oh, we have.
So this might be a bit shorter than usual.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually haven't written my blog yet. It's due today.
That's why I was like, what did you write, Patrick?
Yeah. So I don't really have anything to talk about my blog, except I pretty much know what I'm going to write about. And I'll talk a little bit about this now, but I'm going to talk about it more in topics of interest, because there's a connection. And I'd like to blog about a small organism. It's unicellular, and its name is Chlamydomonas reinhardtii. And the thing that's really...
We should have named a child that.
We should have. Clammy.
Clammy.
So the thing about clammy, which is really cool, is it's a model organism. Mm-hmm. In other words, out of many different similar organisms, it somehow got picked as a model organism by researchers, meaning an organism that they will use to perform experiments. And this happens basically when someone decides they're going to use a particular organism, and then the next researcher reads about it and wants to do the same type of research. They want to compare their results to the person who went before. So usually, when a particular organism has been chosen, it tends to be reused over and over, and that's how model organisms get established. I think the most common ones are probably, so first we should say clammy is a single-celled algae, really. It's got 2 flagella, and it swims around, and it can photosynthesize.
Should we call this the charismatic mega
the charismatic
mega species For
unicellular eukaryotes. Because it is a eukaryote. So for those who do not know, Russ Mittermeier used to be the president, I guess, of the World Wildlife Fund.
Yes.
I suspect it was in the 1970s, possibly also in the 80s, I'm not sure. And we met him a while back, and I think he's the one who coined the term charismatic megaspecies, with the idea that if you want to save a forest and tigers live in there, well, tigers just look awesome. And so you want people to care about the forest with all the organisms, then you showcase the tiger.
And I also think that allowed them to create a story around that particular creature.
Right.
So that people would understand a little more of what was going on.
Right.
Environmentally.
Now, do you remember meeting him and he had this thing about a certain type of monkey?
Yeah. And the way they looked at
The way they looked at you, they had the, because they had big eyes.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I love him and everything and he's done great stuff, but I remember even back then thinking, right, big eyes. I mean, yeah. They look cute and everything, and they look at you with intelligence, but really, that's an awfully small brain they have in there. Tarsiers, that's what they were, right? Tarsiers. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but Chlamydomonas is very interesting because it swims around, and the appendages it uses for swimming, flagella, have the basic structure that flagella and cilia have in all eukaryotic organisms. And I'm intimately aware of many of the diseases associated with humans and defects in cilia and flagella because of my work. This structure that's inside the flagellum is called an axoneme. And the proteins that power it are similar to, well, no, they're not similar. How can I put this? Most people are famous, are aware of myosin. Myosin is probably the most famous motor protein because it's in our muscles. But dynein, a different protein, totally unrelated, is the protein that's found in cilia and flagella and power them. And so that's a fascinating area of study. And a lot of the early work done on figuring out what the structure of that protein is and how it fits into the axoneme in general has been done on Chlamydomonas. And the reason is very simple. They swim, right? So you take a bunch of clammies and you mutate them somehow, you know, radiation, or I don't know what they use because it's not my work, but basically you mutate them and then you look with a microscope and find ones that don't swim. Or that swim incorrectly, and then you isolate them, breed them, and then you've got a whole bunch with a particular mutation, and then you look for which genes got mutated, and you try to do structure function correlations, because, you know, you try to find the gene that got mutated, then you know they don't swim well, so you've got a phenotype, and then you look structurally by electron micrographs at the axoneme and see if there's a piece missing. So that's all really fascinating stuff, and I think I'll probably write about that in the blog.
Yeah.
That's the plan.
Do you know that I ordered them into my classroom?
Chlamydomonas? Really?
And my partner teacher got really angry because it wasn't written down as one of our microbes. It wasn't an amoeba. It wasn't a euglena or a paramecium. And what was I thinking? And I was like, but there's totally a cool factor. She goes, what do you mean? The kids loved it, though, because they moved all over, and so, they were just crazy.
Yeah.
But, of course,
they move extremely fast.
Extremely fast.
When you look at videos slowed down, you don't realize. I think the beat frequency is around 60 hertz at room temperature.
They move in crazy motion.
Yeah.
And the students, having them under the microscope and then showing clips of them up at the front, it really egged them on to to look at them and look at them again to see what they could really see using a
Know. Because they saw the slow down motion.
Right. And they're seeing, you know, this incredible microscope and video.
Yeah.
And then they had something different.
Okay. So that's my future blog entry for this week, which I may get to tonight.
Coming to you soon.
Coming to you soon.
Mm-hmm.
I've been pretty happy with, this is the second time that we've had really just horrible weeks in terms of just how busy we've been.
Mm-hmm.
And we've maintained the blog and the podcasts.
Right.
Within a day or two.
Right.
Of when they were due.
Mm-hmm. So. I agree. And by the way, when he says horrible, he means just, you know, chaotic, crazy, normal life. It's not something that
is
like, you know, terrible going on around us. Yeah. It's just, you know, the chaos of life.
Yep. Yep. Just being extra busy.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see. So that's it for the blogs.
Okay.
So the next part are topics of interest.
Ooh, and I want to ask you. So,
okay.
What did you do last week?
Why was I so busy?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't even here.
No, you were not.
We're in Chapel Hill in North Carolina, but this entire last week I was in Galveston, Texas for a conference, and it was a Gordon conference, and for those who do not know, they're quite special. They're usually much smaller than big scientific conferences. So we're talking about 100 to, well, maybe 170 or 80 people are the ones that I've been involved with. I don't know. Maybe there's some that are quite a bit larger than that. But
I think there
it's,
are.
You know, compared to those thousands of researchers that show up at, or tens of thousands, at some of the conferences like experimental biology and some of the other ones, this is quite small. So, and they're centered on a particular field. And scientists that go there are actually not allowed to publish anything that they hear at the conference. And none of the abstracts or posters presented at the conference are published.
So why have Gordon conferences?
Well, the idea is that you're able to really talk about your wildest ideas, and you will be meeting with the people that are the experts in your field, and everybody is going to talk about, you know, what are the next steps in the research and what's the newest stuff happening. And so it allows you to talk about things that you might not be ready to publish about, but that you want to try to tease out with others. And the conferences in my field are every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm going to have to come out of the closet and say what the conference is about.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm filled with trepidation. What? Because I've said already, I study the respiratory system, the human respiratory system.
Kind of vague.
Yeah, it's a little bit vague. And a little bit misleading, because you think respiration is gas exchange.
Alveoli.
But no, not me. I study the conducting airways.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is basically the tubes that carry the air from outside and, you know, through your lungs to the alveoli, and then back out to the outside air. Just the tubes, not the gas exchange surfaces. And why study these tubes? Well, because everything you breathe in gets deposited on these tubes. And we have cilia, which are constantly beating to push all this stuff up the airways. And
like little rose petals.
Like rose petals, like Mom would say. So why am I coming out of the closet? Because there are two components to this. And one component is cilia, which I study, and they're really fascinating structures with the axoneme, like in Chlamydomonas, and I mean, that's really sounds cool, right? Mm-hmm. But then the other part. Yes, everybody, I study mucus. So.
You've seen the commercials.
Yeah, I study, half of my work is mucus. So what does that mean? Well, the cilia, they're bathed in what's known as the periciliary fluid. And over the top of that is, well, actually, even periciliary fluid is a misnomer because it's not just a fluid. It's more like a gel. But on the surface is truly what is known as mucus. And they beat it up out of the conducting airways up into the throat where we swallow it. And we don't even realize we're doing this all the time. And every little particle and germ you breathe in gets deposited on the conducting airways and then gets trapped in the mucus and then ends up in your throat where you swallow it. So, yeah, that is what this Gordon conference was about. It was called, I might have the first two words switched, I'm not sure, but it's about cilia, mucus, and mucociliary interactions. And boy, this was a really good year. Mm-hmm. I have to say there was a lot of fantastic research and it was quite well organized. So let's see. I talked about Chlamydomonas already. The reason that it was kind of special this year, and this is not really this year that this is new, but it's been something that's been growing. I remember years ago, probably the first time I went, must have been in 2003, I think. And there was a lot of work on Chlamydomonas because all the genetics allowed us to start to identify which proteins were part of the motor units that power the stroke of the cilia or flagella. And so there were all these names of proteins that were subcomponents. And they were all proteins in Chlamydomonas. And really, this year, there was a humongous number of proteins that their names were specifically associated with humans. In other words, these are human proteins. And this is really new, right? Because how do you experiment on people? You can't. And yet we've slowly figured out which proteins are part of ours. And basically, we're talking about the concept of homologs. In other words...
Can you explain what a homolog is?
Right. So a homolog is a protein that occurs in both us and some other animal.
Okay.
And it's not going to be exactly the same because evolution has driven us apart mm-hmm. from the time of our common ancestor, but not enough to make the proteins totally different. Mm-hmm. And so since there's still some similarity, especially in function, mm-hmm. then they're homologs.
Right.
So how are we doing for time?
It's 6:39.
But how long have we been going? Oh, that's, I guess, yeah. About 18 minutes. So we're fine. Okay. So that's a big thing, right? And the reason that that's really important to humans is because of a particular disease called primary ciliary dyskinesia, or PCD, mm-hmm. For short. And it's a defect of cilia. And it's mm-hmm. a genetic defect. In other words, you didn't do anything to get it.
Right.
You just get it from your family, and your cilia don't beat right, and then you get recurring lung infections, and there can be other problems. So another big thing, which has been now part of these meetings and part of scientific research for a while, which has just always fascinated since it started up, is cryo-electron tomography.
And cryo, as in freezing?
As in freezing.
Okay.
So basically, they take a sample, and they freeze it, and then they do electron microscopy on it, but they do it from so that they figure out a three-dimensional structure.
Okay.
And if I remember correctly, I'm not sure, but I think that the resolution they're getting is 3.3 nanometers.
Wow.
So this is really seeing individual protein components. And you can see just very accurately what a structure looks like. Mm-hmm. Now, there's always worries, right? When mm-hmm. you do that, since it is the ultimate form of describing a structure at that resolution, how do you know? You don't have anything else to compare it to. How do you know you just didn't come up with garbage data, right?
Right.
And the reason a lot of the structures are known to be correct is you have a defect, either in Chlamydomonas or in a person, and you do the cryo-electron tomography, and you see a little piece missing every single time. And you can match up that piece then to the function of the cilia or the flagella, how they're not beating.
Got it.
Right? So it's kind of a check on it, on itself. And those structures are really fantastic. Let's see. And a lot of this work is done by a particular person, Daniela Nicastro. And she's really, from my point of view, a wizard of this type of stuff. What else do we have? Some work on nodal cilia, which I'm not going to talk about now because that's another long story. But they are present in the fetus for humans and embryo for animals. And they don't beat like regular cilia in the, well, regular cilia.
Right.
There's no such thing as a regular cilia. But to me, those cilia I study are in the airways.
Right.
And they beat the mucus up towards the throat.
And they wouldn't really need that.
Well, so the nodal cilia are present in the embryo, and they, and there's two types. Mm-hmm. And the ones that beat more kind of in a spiral or in a circle. And the flow they generate is responsible for breaking our symmetry on the left versus right axis. So what does that mean? Well, we're different on the left side versus the right side. And the prototypical example of something that's different on our two sides is our heart. People say the heart is on the left side, right?
Right.
It's basically the way the angle of the heart is in the center of the chest, and the fact that the left side grows so much larger because of having to beat in the systemic versus pulmonary circulation. Mm-hmm. So it's at that point where the cilia are beating in the in the embryonic node that you get this symmetry breaking. And so there was a fair bit of research on that. And the last, I don't know, maybe this started about 6 years ago. I'm trying to remember. I might have that wrong. But a lot of work started to be done on congenital heart disease when a group out of Pittsburgh, mostly headed by Cecilia Lowe, started to look for genetic lesions that resulted in congenital heart disease. So she wasn't interested in heart disease. And she didn't really have a bias as to what kind of gene she was looking for, except for the fact that it caused congenital heart disease, meaning some abnormality in how the heart or the circulatory system was all put together. Mm-hmm. And a humongous number of the genes she found were genes associated with defects in cilia, which she says, you know, which, you know, not having been into the field of cilia was surprising to her. And so now she's kind of in our field because, you know, there's this connection
great
with
connection.
Cilia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic idea is if the nodal cilia are defective, you don't get this flow in the node and you don't correctly break your symmetry.
Got it.
So a very common finding in people that have primary cilia dyskinesia is their heart is on the right instead of the left.
Mm-hmm.
It's called situs inversus. But you can imagine if you're not breaking your symmetry correctly and your entire circulatory system is different left versus right, you could have weird connections happening and the heart formed incorrectly and so on. So that's connection there. Let's see. And well, I mean, the meeting was fantastic. There was tons of other stuff and I just thought those were the ones that I found most interesting.
Yeah, you were highlighting.
Yeah. And
the ones that stood out.
Exactly. And a lot, personally, I love a lot of the modeling, but I think I'm not going to talk too much about that. But I've done a bit of the mathematical modeling, and so that's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
So what else do I have for my topics of interest? How far have we gone? 25 minutes. So I think I can talk a bit about more about being over there. I flew Southwest. That was kind of interesting. found out that the cruising altitude, I think they said, was 10,000 feet. So that's up there.
Mm-hmm.
How many meters would that be? That'd be like over 3,000 meters?
Yes, it would be.
Anyway, and we had a flight going over. So the meeting was in Galveston in Texas, just south of Houston. And we had a flight. I'm trying to remember. It was from Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a medical emergency on the plane. And I think people believe that because we had a medical emergency and it happened early on,
mm-hmm.
that our pilot was allowed to gun it and speed up our trip so we could get to Galveston faster.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that be as it is, somehow we took 40 minutes off our flight. So from instead of 3 hours and 45 minutes, we were 3 hours and 5 minutes. Now, that's pretty amazing.
So that's you didn't have to go the inner city limit speed.
I guess not. So, I mean, I thought maybe you could take off. I mean, I've pretty much figured that these airplanes go, you know, not full speed, but, you know, they're not going to be wasting time up there.
Mm-hmm.
But, wow, that's...
That's quite the bit,
yeah.
Quite a chunk of time.
Let's see. I think that's all about my trip out there. I had a couple other things for topics of interest. One is this really fun YouTube set of videos. Well, two sets. One called Number File and another one called 64 Symbols, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really short, fun. The Number File is about mathematics. Really mm-hmm. narrow topics. Explained in a just real fun way, just talking and showing a few things. And the presentation is done quite well. And 64 Symbols, I think, is the physics version. And I think they have a few other similar type
mm-hmm.
Sets. And I think for kids, they would be a lot of fun to get excited about. Just, you know, really simple concepts. Mm-hmm. And, well, I mean, the concepts aren't always simple, but the explanations are short. You know, the videos are 5 to 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe some of them a little bit longer, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought those were really neat. So if you want to check them out, Number File is a lot of fun. What else do I have? So maybe I'll go back to the meeting for a bit.
Okay.
So this is actually about sitting there in presentations.
Oh.
And I know you want to talk about presentation mm-hmm. styles later. So I'm going to leave that for a bit. But this is about taking notes. This is the first time for most of the meeting that I sat there with my computer instead of paper and took notes on my computer, except for the first day. And basically, I shut off the graphical interface mm-hmm. and basically went just to a text screen
mm-hmm.
and used a program called Tmux to divide the screen into different parts. And I didn't have a place to plug in my computer. So it was on battery, and this computer is a bit old,
mm-hmm.
so I wasn't sure how it was going to do. So I had a
Linux-based computer.
Well, it was already originally a Windows
right.
computer,
but you had swapped it over.
Yeah,
It's
running. It's running Kubuntu, I think, Kubuntu. An old version. So I had a script on one panel, let's say, running. And every 3 minutes, it would update and show me what the battery setting was. And I was recording it also so that I could go back afterwards and see
mm-hmm.
what the state of the battery was every 3 minutes and graph it. And then when I'd get back to the room, I'd plug it in, but keep the program going. So I would then see it come back. And I think that the state of the battery that they're reporting it's just too precise. It makes me think they're just absolutely not really checking the battery. Right? Because when I plotted that, it was like a straight line going down for 3 hours. Right?
Right.
And it was, I was getting close to running out of battery, but I still probably had a half hour. But it's just like, how can it be going down that evil? I mean, the voltage can't be going down that. It makes me think pretty much they said, okay, the battery must be at such and such charge, and we're going to start counting down, regardless of what the voltage is. That's what it looks like to me. Right. I don't think it's...
It's a time countdown.
It's just a time countdown. That's, yeah, that's what it looks like anyway. On the other hand, for the battery charge, that looks like it recharges quickly at first and then asymptotes out.
Tapers off.
Yeah. So that's, I don't know if that's also on a, I mean, that could be done with a function, right?
Right.
Of time also. Yeah, I'm not sure. So that was kind of interesting. And then the other thing is my notes were just on text, and this was really neat because there were absolutely no distractions. Because all I could do was just type in into my text file. You know, there was no mouse I could possibly click. There's no mouse, you know, connection on the computer.
Right.
Or anything. So it was a lot of fun. So that was taking notes. And what's really fantastic is for the first time is my notes are searchable. And you know, sometimes I was typing, oh, I have this great idea, right? And so I type in the idea. But a lot of times I just type in, you know, someone says a word that's a technical word and they haven't said it before. It's the first time. So I type it in just kind of as a reminder of that's what they were talking about.
Right.
And now everybody's talks is searchable through this text file. Every keyword they said just got typed in. It takes 2 seconds, you know, to type it in. So that's kind of neat and be a good reminder when I go through it again, I hope. Let's see. What else do I have? So nothing else except for one totally unrelated topic, and that's we had an orienteering meet today.
Right, right.
And, well, we actually ran during the meet.
Yeah, we did not expect to participate in it today.
No, because we were helping out a friend who was directing the meet. And so I ran the registration and the cash and handing out the maps. And then you were the starter.
Yeah, I was the starter and finisher.
Yeah, which is also pretty involved because you get their registration forms and you have to put them in the right course. And then when they get back, make sure
They're removed from the course.
They're removed from the course. And then with being so busy, we just wanted to get home, but that didn't, at the end. But that didn't happen.
No. So, or we would have been making this broadcast 2 hours earlier.
I think so, yeah. Anyway, but it's all good. I mean, we helped to pick up controls, and we're very happy to do it because you know, whoever's directing a meet, that's an awful lot of work.
It is an incredible amount of work. And, you have to get the controls in. There's just no way to put it in a different way.
Exactly. And at the end of your day, it's your responsibility if you're the director.
Right.
You've got to go out there and get the stuff if you didn't find enough people to get them. So.
Right. So if someone doesn't bring back a control, it's your deal.
Yep. You're out there tramping the woods.
Yeah. Which Ian did.
He did. Yeah. So Ian Shields was the guy who ran this meet, and it went, I think, really well. It was cold.
Oh, I think it went really well.
I mean, it's not incredibly cold, but...
Very cold for North Carolina.
Very cold, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was definitely below freezing.
Yeah.
And when you're running the registration or you're the starter and you're just having to sit there, boy, does that get cold when you can't move.
Yeah. Although we tried to dress in layers.
Oh, I thought I was overdressed.
But, yeah, I did too.
But when we were sitting there, even with a blanket over my knees and stuff, after a good half hour of not being able to move,
I had to start jumping up and down to get my toes back in order.
Okay, I don't have your sheet, but that's everything for my topics. Okay. I don't have your sheet.
Oh.
Did you put it someplace?
Maybe you put it here. And I was waiting for you to hand it to me. Okay. So one of the things that I've been working at is getting Raspberry Pis for the classroom.
Still.
And they've arrived.
Oh, they have arrived.
They have arrived. That's good. So this week I hope to use them. And of course, there's always a catch. So I have Raspberry Pis coming. The kids are excited to use them. They're going to use them on Thursday. And I may not make it back because I have a district meeting.
When's the district meeting?
Thursday.
It is on Thursday.
Yeah, it's on Thursday. So, Amr...
Because this is running at lunchtime still.
Right. This is the enrichment class. So, this would be on Thursday, unfortunately.
Okay.
So, Amr is going to step up, and I said, okay, I'll assign everybody where they should be, and you'll make sure that the class runs. And he was very excited because it is a maker space. And so the whole point of it is to get experience in different areas of the technology that we have around the room.
Right.
And so the students expect to rotate around and to, you know.
So he's one of the students.
He's one of the students.
And he's going to actually run it.
Yeah. So I think he's probably wishing that I don't show up on Thursday so he can take over and run it the way it should be.
Be any adult supervision?
There will be. There will be my student teacher there.
Okay.
But she doesn't have the technology background or interest in it. And great person. It's just she, the students will need someone who's really invested and excited about the technology.
All right. Well, good for him.
Yeah. So he was very excited.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see. And I think they're going to have a good meeting, whether I'm there or not.
So you have a competition coming up.
I do. They have a STEM competition coming up. That's the other thing.
During the enrichment club, they're building for the competition?
No. So as a club, they decided they wanted to keep their STEM competition to the club, which was at lunch.
Okay.
And I entered into the competition because the students wanted a competition to be in.
Right.
And the students that come at lunch regularly are the ones that said, I think it should just be at lunch. And I was like, okay. I'll go with what you say. And so they're building carts. Some groups are building, and really not knowing where the building is going to take them.
How many groups do you have?
I have 5 groups now.
5. Mm-hmm. And do any of the groups have actually a working cart yet?
2 are ready to set. Uh-huh. A fuel cell, or not a fuel cell, a solar cell on top of their car.
Very cool.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're getting overcast weather, but we'll use a lamp. We'll just plug in a lamp and run along beside it.
So are all the cars solar cars?
Yes. So it's a solar competition.
Ah, so they have to be.
They have to be.
Right.
So they can build it in any design they choose, using any materials, except for they have to keep their 1.5 volt motor and the solar cell.
Can they have energy storage on the car, like a battery or a fuel cell? So it's got to be straight solar to the motor.
Mm-hmm.
But if they put capacitors on there, would that be considered...
No one has come up with that, and therefore, it is not an option.
Okay. Is it something you're going to... I mean, I don't know. Maybe you really can't.
I don't...
Maybe it could actually be dangerous. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't give them ideas like that, because they're...
Also, I don't know. That probably wouldn't work unless you really upped the voltage, right?
Right.
I mean, how much energy could you store without upping the voltage? And that'd be pretty complicated.
Right. So. And honestly, like the biggest argument I have with them is that they can't have more motors than one. And that they can, they cannot have 3 gears going at different angles.
Right. So it's really silly stuff that they've decided in their mind
that it works. That and they're like, I want the screw gear. And I'm like, the screw gear? And they're like, oh, it's called a worm gear. And I'm like, the worm gear?
Wait, so why do you need that exactly? Just because I want it.
Yeah.
Because it's so cool looking.
Yeah.
It's like, but it doesn't work.
I know. So I'm like, okay.
Well, it's not that it doesn't work. It's like, it doesn't work for your design.
Design, right.
So you have to,
And so it's these weird
arguments. That's the thing about eighth grade.
And it's like, okay, well, but that won't, the gears have to touch for it to make the wheel move. Right, right.
It's a blast, though.
It is. It's a lot of fun. And even though I have silly arguments like that, I have some groups that are really going to take it to a new level. So all joking aside, you have both extremes. The other thing is, as we were thinking about things, we've been talking about presentations. And this is a strange topic to bring up in a podcast.
Well, scientific presentations are, I mean, they're kind of, if you're interested in science and engineering, being able to present what you're doing is kind of the culmination. I mean, it's not just making something and having it work. It's showing people.
Right.
And being part of a community.
In a purposeful way.
Right. Right.
So that they see, okay, I get it. I see the purpose. I see the reason why you're doing all this. Yeah.
And so were you thinking about this? Because, I mean, this is something you wanted to talk about as a topic of interest, you know, presenting stuff. Did you think about that before I came back from the conference?
Yes. Okay. So I've been thinking about this because I will be doing my research this summer on organic production versus organic feed availability.
Yeah, that we talked about last podcast.
And I've been thinking a lot about, well, how can I present it in a way that doesn't have a, like, you know, this incredible bias that, or that.
Infographics.
Infographics is what I need.
The new keyword.
Yeah. But making sure that it doesn't dumb down information, but it provides information to an audience where they can actually invest in and understand that particular topic better.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's done well right now. And I think that we're used to the sales job, and the sales job isn't what I want.
Right. I think that, well, one of the main things we discussed is death by PowerPoint.
Right.
There, at the Garden Conference, at least, there was some phenomenal research that I think was presented in just a horrible way, simply because it was slide after slide of many points with no story told.
Right.
And that's really too bad.
It is. And if they had chosen their information wisely, they would not have been able to present everything. But the discussions and the questioning that they would get based on the information that they showed would have been much richer, and there'd been more engagement.
I wonder, I mean, there's a lot of complaints about PowerPoint bullet lists. I mean, it's really not PowerPoint, even though, you know, PowerPoint just happens to be a piece of software that many people use. But basically the concept of doing these presentations where you have slide after slide of bullet points. I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Lawrence Krauss who had said one time, you know, you don't need fancy, flashy stuff. If you're passionate about something and you just talk about it, people will be fascinated just with you talking.
Right.
And he was talking about, who did the Ascent of Man series?
Oh, yeah.
From the 1970s.
We went back and looked at one of the videos of what they said. I can't remember.
Can't remember either. Yeah. We'll have to put it for the next podcast as something to talk about. But
it wasn't Carl Sagan, was it?
No, it was someone else.
He did another series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cosmos was the Carl Sagan
was the one. But it's like comparable.
Yeah, so Lawrence Krauss was actually responding to someone asking him about Cosmos as done by Neil deGrasse Tyson. Mm-hmm. And he was basically saying, yeah, it's all fine and good, but really how much of an impact is it going to have on kids or anyone? Because really there's a lot of flash in it, and that's not what's needed. Anyway, we're kind of digressing here, but I think the point that I found interesting is the whole idea that a lot of scientific information can be just a simple story, and you can have a set of bullet points that kind of make it sound like everything is a little tiny piece of information and it comes in a row. And if you just said almost the same thing, but just spoke it in a sequence of sentences, that's a narration, right? It's just modified slightly. And you just didn't put any bullet points up there at all. You just spoke to people, right? You could put up a picture just generally about what you're talking about, but it really doesn't matter. I don't know. I think maybe people would actually be more receptive to the information, be able to pay attention more easily and absorb more of the information.
But I also think you have to prepare your presentation and really be thoughtful about what you're putting in that presentation before you go, and you have to practice it several times so that when you get to the audience, you have your goal. You know what the message you want to get across. You have a goal for what you hope the people will get from your message and walk away with. And I think when you think about, okay, what do I want that audience to get from this particular presentation? And start with that and build your presentation, that you build a much more sound compact presentation for people to listen to.
Yeah, actually, I think that when you said you have to practice your presentation if you're going to do that, I think that you are right on, because you can't get up there and not be prepared. Or it's not enough to know your material.
No.
You have to have crafted it into a story that pulls people along and makes them understand what are the important points, what are the interesting details.
Right.
And
have specifically chosen those details purposefully for your message.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Totally agree.
But I mean, I don't know. I know, some people say, oh, this is just so boring to have teachers that just stand in front of you and lecture, and you know, you need these fancy visual aids to pull students in. Mm-hmm. And I just cannot disagree anymore. Some of the most fascinating teachers I've had at different times are teachers that did not require any kind of. And I think, I mean, we both had Dr. Carlisle at St. Lawrence University, and he would come in, put his little briefcase on the desk, and just start walking back and forth in front of the classroom.
He wouldn't even look at us that much.
No, kind of at a spot above our heads. And he would just lecture until he was done. And it was the most fascinating pieces of history I've ever heard.
Yeah, lectures. I totally agree. He did not have a look or a charismatic spirit drew us along. No. It was his passion about the topic.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it really made you read, it ensured that you read the materials for the next lecture.
Oh, yeah.
Because he did not spend his time explaining the basics for you.
No.
He expected you to know a lot of the time period from having read your textbook, and and he would just fill in all the what was important and how different parts related to each other, and examples from particular events in history, and it's absolutely fascinating.
And he made connections that the book just didn't really elaborate on.
Anyway, I you know, every presentation at the Gordon Conference had a lot of graphics and stuff, and you know, of course, you're going to need them. But I, you know, it's common, especially in the harder sciences part of these talks, where you're really working with raw data, to have someone just put up a graph, and it's so complicated, and they just leave it up there, and they just talk about, you know, how the data was obtained, where it came from, what was done, and stuff. And they've spent half their time just telling a story, and by the end of it, you really understand why this is so important.
Right.
Because it's so hard to get this information. You know, things like, you know, how protein, these motor proteins, how these, the forces on them are calculated and measured, and what we can tell about them, and what we can't know because of the requirements of making the measurements in an actual experiment.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah. So scientific presentations.
So that brings me to another part that I was thinking of discussing tonight, is scientific phenomenon.
That's and not on the list.
It is.
It is
so
on the list?
We're driving back from the and there's this bizarro cloud. You have to understand, we live in North Carolina. We don't get cold weather often. And well, you know, cold weather could hit 30, maybe hit minus, what, 2, 3 to 4 degrees Celsius at night.
Well, that's quite common.
Yeah, that's what I
minus
said.
Minus 4 in early in the morning before the sun rises.
Before the sun rises and that. But we're up for a big cold spell. So we're driving home, and as I'm driving, I'm like, what is that mist in the distance? So about 200 meters in front of the car, you could see
just kind
this
of started,
kind of haze.
Yeah, this haze.
Yeah.
Only over the road.
Yeah.
And then we're driving along, and you could see it being flipped up like
by
smoke
the
from the tires. And, I mean, I don't know, but I think we came to the same conclusion.
Yeah.
That they somehow salted the roads.
Or should
even
we
though
call
the roads
it
are totally
assaulted
dry.
Assaulted the roads.
Assaulted the roads with salt.
Yeah. It was so bizarre.
Yeah.
I have never seen so much salt used.
On a dry road.
On a dry road.
Yeah. So, I mean, we are supposed to get some wintry mixed type of weather.
Tuesday. This is Sunday.
This is Sunday, yes. This is very strange.
It amazed me. Anyway.
And it was amazing how, I mean, I don't know if they actually put on salt that was very fine, or if having putting it on
solution.
Well, if it was if it totally dried up, and then having car after car go over it has just turned it into a mist.
Yeah. Very strange, but
yeah, that was a phenomenon.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to future plans.
Okay, future.
Future plans.
Plans. Do you want me to go first?
Sure.
Yours is kind of blank there, but anyway, we'll see.
That's why you're going first.
That's why I'm going first. Okay. Well, some of what I have down is what we've had already. We have our own orienteering meet to direct on the 22nd of March.
Yeah, it's coming up.
So that's getting close. And you just called up the person in charge of the area.
Right.
And
I
sent
emailed
an email,
the ranger.
So that's coming along. And I guess we need to get out there. I haven't looked at our schedule, but it's getting desperate getting that course finished.
Right.
So maybe next weekend, we should get out there.
It'll probably be nice by the weekend, so it'll be cold through the week.
Okay.
It'll probably perk up.
I have to say, even though it was really cold just sitting and not being able to move, once we were on the trail, you heated up more than me or faster than me. It's okay if you're walking around.
Oh, yeah. So. It's just you can't stand in one place and not move.
Exactly.
Yeah. In the shade.
In the shade, yeah. So that's part of the future plans. Another thing, actually, this I haven't talked about. I made a kind of shelves that fit over one of our desks, and I first created a model of the shelf with OpenSCAD. I think that's how it's pronounced. I'm not absolutely certain. And that was fantastic in getting everything exactly the right size and and seeing exactly what would be the final product. And I think I'd like to do that for the desk in our bedroom, so I might bring that up this week and put together a model.
Oh, that sounds neat.
Yep. So that's part of the plans. I hope I get to it. And then the third thing is something we've had before. It's the ATmega 328 module that we got made from OSH Park, and which I haven't touched since going to Galveston. And even the weekend before, I haven't touched it because there was so much to do before going off to the meeting.
Right.
You know, poster to put together for my presentation and so on. So this week I'll probably work at that some and see if I can't get that working. Do some more tests on it. And that's all I have.
Okay. Well, I think that ends our...
Hey, what about your future plans?
I'm working on getting Raspberry Pis up and going with the kids, which means that I have to make sure I have all the documentations ready for them to access online so they can get going and have it ready. My goal is not to talk them through it, but for them to read and troubleshoot through it in groups.
So do you have Raspberry Pis already?
I do. They're in the class. I do have to get some.
Do any of the kids already use them for stuff?
So there's... three of them who have told me they've worked somewhat with a Raspberry Pi.
At home. Okay.
So, which I think they've watched someone else set it up.
Right.
But they were not allowed to touch it.
Yeah.
So,
you don't expect the kids to set up the OS and everything just to start
fooling. I expect them to kind of start up the Raspberry Pi. I'll have the OS ready to plug in and.
Right.
And they hook it up and get it running. My goal is for them to hook it up and get it running.
Oh, right. So it'll already be tested and they're to put together the hardware.
Right. At school. So they're going to put together all the hardware and the cases and that.
Did any of them talk about using the GPIO pins to control lights and sense temperature sensors and other things like that?
Amr at one point really wanted to do that.
Yeah.
But he's become my programmer.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, but that's programming.
Yeah.
Of. Yeah, it is.
I'm just not sure.
Has he used for programming?
He's using C++.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, the Raspberry Pi was meant, Pi is for Python.
Right.
But, I mean, I've tried Python and I know I should learn it, but really I've been so, done so much work with C. And so when I went to the Pi, I naturally found it much faster to put together stuff in C, and and it worked fine. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't matter what language you use as long as
you
it depends on what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a particular sensor I wanted to use and someone had written a library already that handles that sensor or that motor or whatever through GPIO pins, and it was in Python, I'd find it easier to use their library and learn the little bit of Python that I need than to try to write my own drivers with C. So, so they're going to be starting to use the Python this week?
Right. So the goal is to set it up this week.
So that's your future plans.
Yeah. So they probably won't get a Py running fully.
Okay.
By the end of class. But
well, they might.
They may. I don't know. I think it'll take two hours.
I think it's more the question of what are they going to do with it.
Right.
That might take them a bit longer, too, if they decide they want to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, because, I mean, all they have to do for the hardware is just plug in the mouse, the keyboard, the monitor, and then just turn it on.
Get the Wi-Fi going.
Mm-hmm. It could be a bit tricky.
Yeah.
So you might need to help them with that.
Right.
Okay. Is that...
That's everything.
That's everything. Okay. So thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvest podcast.
And I hope to...
The blog.
Don't forget to read our blog. And we will be back in another 2 weeks.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.